Hello, and welcome to the latest ClearBridge podcast. This is Jeff Schulze, CFA, Head of Economic and Market Strategy at ClearBridge Investments. ClearBridge is a global equity manager with $177 billion in assets under management, committed to delivering long-term results through authentic active management. We integrate ESG considerations into our fundamental research process across all strategies. It's been about 18 months since I've had today's guest in the podcast booth. Halfway through 2022, energy and basic materials analyst Adam Myers joined me to discuss what was next for 2022's energy rally as the sector finished the year the top performer in the S&P 500, returning 65%. Since then, we've seen recession fears and a lackluster China keep oil prices a touch lower in 2023 and largely range-bound in the $75 to $85 a barrel range. But energy companies have been far from quiet as a tidal wave of M&A activity has begun to reshape the sector, and these acquisitions notwithstanding, producers have shown more financial discipline and a willingness to return cash to shareholders. We've also seen some slowing to production growth in the U.S., begging the question of higher oil prices in the future, which larger post-merger energy companies might be able to take advantage of. It's a great time to check back with Adam in today's podcast. Let's make a deal. Energy Edition. Adam, I can't believe it's been almost 2 years since we've been in the booth together. A lot has changed.
Great to be back.
Great to be back, right? But very different dynamic than we talked back in 2022. So a lot of ground to cover. And the first thing I really want to talk about is that you've been seeing headlines over the past few months of M&A activity. And we got a headline today, right? Why has this been happening? And what does consolidation actually mean for investors, right? We had Exxon buying Pioneer, Diamondback Energy acquiring Endeavor Energy, Chesapeake buying Southwestern. I mean, this is a good thing for investors, largely speaking, right?
Absolutely. No, I mean, as you mentioned, tidal wave, maybe just to put some numbers behind this and put some context around it, we're essentially talking about $210 billion worth of value of E&P upstream M&A over the past year alone. To put that in perspective, that's seven times more than what we saw in 2022 alone.
Wow.
Right? So in terms of, the rationale for these deals is clear, right? Synergies are typically highly visible, right? You remove G&A redundancies, rig redundancies, increase overlapping acreage to then extend longer lateral development, which just means lower well costs, right? So couple that with the fact that, let's take Diamondback acquisition of Endeavor. Core Midland Basin acreage that was, run by a private company that was growing that at double digits, right? So they were burning through their inventory very fast, didn't believe in this capital discipline free cash flow model. Diamondback comes in, is able to rein that production back, elongate the longevity of that inventory, and apply it to its cash returns business model. So that's a key reason why you saw, a very strong response to that deal in particular. ExxonMobil acquiring Pioneer.
Massive, very similar. Massive deal.
Massive. And it had been rumored to occur for a long time, and they finally pulled the trigger, right? I mean, again, the other factor here, right, especially as it pertains to the majors, is there's a big free cash flow yield arbitrage to be had, right? The majors traded a notable premium just given to their more defensive business model, deeper inventory. So being able to go out and buy a company like Pioneer or buy a company like Endeavor, you're essentially taking that free cash flow and re-rating it, right, in the public market, because nobody's going to change the multiple or the free cash flow yield that they put on ExxonMobil, for example. So it makes a lot of sense. The other key factor to pay attention to here is also this increases leverage over the oil field service companies, right? So maybe just to put some stats around it as it pertains to the Permian. Remember, the Permian is the last core basin in the U.S. that has inventory left. Top seven producers essentially operate about a little over 60% of the total production in the Permian. That compares to 20% back in 2015. So what this means, increased buyer power of the oil field service companies, likely being able to mitigate their pricing, et cetera, which helps returns. So to your question, what does this mean for investors? This is better entities, better public entities to invest in. Deeper inventory depth, right? Investors typically want to see 10 plus years of inventory. This is deeper inventory depth, higher percentage of low cost inventory that can support that cash returns business model.
Now, you mentioned a second ago the potential peaking of U.S. production, right? And the U.S. is a pretty big player in the oil space, makes up about 16% of the world's supply. Permian has really been the only area of growth over the last couple of years, but even the Permian is showing signs of break-even or even potentially declines at this point. So What does that mean for the U.S.'s role as the top swing producer? Does it mean that we're going to likely see U.S. production move lower from here? And obviously, is that a net tailwind to oil stocks in general?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, if you take a look back, just the embracement of the E&P capital discipline model, production growth of 0 to 5% annually, was already a reset lower in what we knew to be growth here in the United States. Previously, we were growing double digits. Any type of commodity price strength was immediately short-lived, right? It made for a very difficult business model for investors to get behind. Not only is the underlying commodity obviously very volatile, but when the business model itself is volatile, it makes for a difficult vehicle to invest
in. A lower multiple, all things considered.
Absolutely. As it pertains to the U.S.'s role as the sole swing producer, it is no longer the sole swing producer, right? So what we saw is that Saudi Arabia and OPEC Plus are really back in the driver's seat here, right? And we saw evidence of that last year, right? Saudi Arabia in particular was able to step in unilaterally with cuts to defend a $75 to $80 per barrel floor in the commodity, right? So if you have a more rational U.S. that is going to stick to 0 to 5% growth, and OPEC is, on average, requires more than $80, right? And Saudi needs 75 to 80.
Just to break even?
Just to break even, right? And so Saudi obviously has more skin in the game now with Saudi Aramco. They're looking to reposition their economy. So I think it's becoming increasingly more understood that they want a structurally high commodity price, which in terms of what it means for the oil stocks is positive across the value chain. Right, it's not only positive for the upstream E&Ps and the refiners whose net realizations are obviously correlated with crude. It's also positive for oil field service companies, right? Because it's creating an environment that is very attractive, resilient, and sustainable to be investing in.
Well, you mentioned a couple areas of the oil stack, and I'm going to pose a question to you. It might be unfair, but I want to talk about oil E&P versus oil service. You mentioned both of them a second ago. I mean, which one do you think is more, they're both interesting, it sounds like, but which one do you think is more interesting over the, call it the next 3 to 5 years?
No, I think we would definitely think both are interesting, just given the fact that we have exposure to on both sides. But as it pertains to this question, I would go with oilfield service here, specifically internationally exposed companies. So think of Baker Hughes, Noble, SLB. I would say they're more interesting here just due to the structural changes that we've seen in the market, right? So we're currently in an upcycle for international and offshore spending. But what's different this time around is if you look at the projects that have been FID that have been sanctioned, 90% plus of them have break-evens of $50 and below.
Wow.
Compare that to the last upcycle in 2013, 2014, projects were getting underwrote at $100 per barrel, right? So what does this mean? This means activity is going to be more resilient, especially at lower commodity prices. Commodity prices are in the low 80s today. Even if you saw a pullback, call it to $50 to $60 per barrel, you're likely to see a lot of that activity continue to chug ahead, which is great as it pertains to the investment thesis for these companies. I would couple that with the fact is we talk a lot about capital discipline for the upstream producers. What probably doesn't get as much love is oil field service companies and the capital discipline that they're also implementing, right? So they've cut investment rates 6 to 8% as a percent of sales, used to be 14% plus for many of the big three. They're focusing on free cash flow. They're no longer building on spec, consolidating the market, making it so that they can push price more consistently, right? And we're seeing that in some of the results that are coming out. So definitely a more favorable environment to be investing in.
Capital discipline, energy companies, it just doesn't really go together, but this has been the regime that we've been in, right? So you mentioned free cash flow generation. With all of the developments that you've kind of mentioned here, what does the cash returns for energy look like?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the way that I like to look at this is kind of total cash return yield, right? Because each company has their own different flavor, different variety, different ratios of base dividends, variable dividends, buybacks. But if you're looking at just total cash return yields, how much is the E&P or how much is the refiner or the oil field service company returning to me? You're talking, look, high single digit, low double digit cash return yields, very attractive for business models that arguably have been de-risked versus the prior cycle, right? So like I mentioned, it's a combination. You know, what's interesting to me is not only are they delivering attractive cash return yields, but you can gain comfort in the sustainability of these cash returns, right? Because balance sheets have been significantly levered. If you look at all the high quality E&P companies, you're looking at some 1x leverage at current futures prices.
So they're less cyclical.
I don't know if I would go there, but I would say the business model itself is certainly de-risked, right? And so what does that mean as it pertains to cash returns? Well, arguably, these guys are building up dry powder that inevitably a downturn will occur. Could they get aggressive on a buyback, right? What would that mean for the stocks?
An energy company in a buyback in a downturn? I thought I'd never hear those words.
That's right, because it's typically, you know, levering up and just to survive, right? And so the difference this time around, if you look at buyback execution historically, it's been counterintuitive if you think about it. Think of the majors, right? Exxon, Chevron, buying more stock back or increasing the actual value of their buyback when their stock's up and oil prices are doing well. As an investor, I want a company getting aggressive on a buyback in a downturn. Well, they can only do that if they have a significant, you know, premier balance sheet.
Very, very new regime compared to pump at any cost in the middle of last decade. I want to switch gears here, and I know we've been focusing mainly on oil, but I want to talk about the natural gas complex. And today, an MMBTU of natural gas trades at $1.57. Back on January 12th, so 6 weeks ago, one MMBTU was $3.31. So you've seen a 50% plus drop in natural gas in less than 2 months. And to put that number in perspective, going all the way back to the beginning of gas trading in 1990, you've only seen one 50% plus drop in a 5 week period, which was last year in January.
Yeah.
And then the second largest was 47% back in March of 2003. So this is a market that's an absolute free fall. So, you know, thinking about $1.57 MMBTU last 25 years, only time it's been lower was right after COVID. So, Adam, what's driving kind of this negative sentiment in the price of natural gas? And then how can we reconcile this against the headlines that I hear about liquid natural gas demand is going to grow by over 50% and by 2040, driven by China, driven by Europe, Southeast Asia? I mean, is this a disconnect? And is the U.S. going to fill that void and is going to close the gap between domestic prices and in the international space?
Yeah, no, great question. I think it's a disconnect in terms of timing, right? So if I start with the first half of your question, focusing, okay, why has natural gas pricing been so weak? So I think we just recorded one of, if not the warmest winter on record in the past 20 years. Couple that with the fact that last winter also disappointed supply at the same time as surprise to the upside, right? So supply out of the Permian, supply even out of Appalachia, as new infrastructure has been added, has also supplied. Folks didn't appreciate just how much production was shut in and ultimately came back to the market. So the market has to force production to shut in. It has to force activity reductions. And the way that it does that is it goes to cash costs, or it goes even below cash cost. And so that's essentially why you've seen such a significant drop. But that's the near term, right? So storage is, I think, currently sitting kind of low double digits as a percent above the typical five-year average that we'd call normal for this time of year. But looking out, right, especially through the next half of the decade, 2025 till 2027, 2028, we're going to get a significant slug of LNG export demand that'll be, you know, we think pretty transformational for the natural gas space and what that means for pricing, right? Because at the end of the day, U.S. nameplate LNG capacity is going to be essentially doubling by the end of the decade.
Wow.
And so even if you get 2 Bcf a year out of associated gas production from the Permian, Appalachia's locked up, doesn't have enough infrastructure, cannot grow. Even if they could grow, as investors, we probably would tell them not to. So what does that mean? That means this incremental gas has to be met by marginal plays. So the marginal cost producers are essentially your Haynesville and some of your marginal MidCon producers. So you look at the cost curve, what do they need to deliver an economic return? What's going to get them to drill? $3.50, $4 plus. But what we've seen recently is, you know, public companies such as Chesapeake stepping up, being capital disciplined, being returns focused to drop that activity now and willing to respond once they get that price signal. So what does that mean? It means that arguably, especially as it pertains to 2025, the supply response will be late. So if that's the case, we get, you know, new projects such as Golden Pass coming online. That means you have to go above the marginal cost, right? So 2025, we could easily see, you know, $4 plus, $5 plus gas, which is fantastic.
300% rise from where we're currently set.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so it certainly supports a bullish outlook. And look, the U.S. has a big role to play in terms of, you know, supporting the energy security and the decarbonization goals of the globe. So, you know, I think we might come back to that later, but.
Well, I guess that's why you get these boom bust periods with commodities. And right now it seems like it's a bust, but it doesn't look like in the distant future that we could be seeing a boom in relatively short order.
Sure.
But you mentioned warm weather. I think we got 2 snowstorms here in New York, which is the first 2 snowstorms that we've had in about 5 years. But undoubtedly, you have climate change that's what's going on. And there's some energy companies that have net zero targets. So help me and the listeners understand what exactly does that mean? how do these companies plan to achieve them? And then, first of all, are they credible? And do you see a changing role in the oil majors with this energy transition as well?
Right. Yeah. So if we take the first half first in terms of the companies that are out there with net zero ambitions, the companies that stand out, again, are the natural gas companies, right? So you're talking about EQT. We expect them to be net zero on a scope one and two basis by the end of this year. EQT was what is one of the largest natural gas companies in the United States, upstream producer. And so what's astonishing is, you know, they've been able to make a lot of pragmatic investments in addition to just improving their overall cycle times, their overall efficiency in the business to really make this a win-win, right? So they're expected to be net zero by the end of 2024. Admittedly, some of that is going to be related to nature-based solutions, carbon offsets. But, you know, at this stage in the game, they're still making absolute emissions reductions. For example, they were able to spend, I think the number was less than, I think it was like 0.5% of cash flow, or maybe less than 1% of cash flow, to reduce their methane emissions by 70%. Essentially, what they did is they went out to all their infrastructure and they replaced these, you call them pneumatic devices. They're essentially pumps, valves, et cetera, that run on, historically, have run on natural gas and essentially are bleeding methane. So they did the aerial look, they used infrared cameras, and they identified, look, this is low-hanging fruit for us. And so, you know, CEO Toby Rice is clear, this industry is going to knock methane emissions out of the park and not even make it a debate that U.S. natural gas is the answer to displace coal, to displace Russia, and to meet energy security needs. And so the other one that's of note as well is Chesapeake. They're expected to be net zero by 2035. You know, other things that these folks are doing, they're early adopters of electric equipment, right? Think of an electric frac fleet. Well, that uses 40 to 60% lower emissions than a typical diesel fleet. Natural gas-driven equipment, obviously, it's right there in the field, so it makes a lot of sense. And then, like I mentioned, just getting more efficient from a cycle time perspective. Now, as it pertains to your point on the major's role in the energy transition, no, we continue to think that this is still underappreciated by the market. Major's role in the energy transition is going to be one of enablement, and it's going to be critical, right? Let's take carbon capture and sequestration. Regardless of what your politics are, both sides of the aisle agree that carbon capture is going to be a key role to decarbonize the globe, right? ExxonMobil has been an early leader in this space because, number one, they own the geology under which we're going to sequester the carbon, right? Let's start there. Number two, they have the expertise and the understanding of the geology. And so the oil field service companies have the expertise as well to work together to sequester this carbon, not just put it there, but also monitor it, right? This is some high-risk stuff. One leak could be significantly detrimental to the local health. So you need somebody, you don't need some common Joe Schmo down the street. You need somebody who's been doing this for decades, right? And that's exactly what the majors are. So that's one core example. You know, ExxonMobil has already signed a number of agreements, not only to decarbonize their own operations, but that of third parties, right? CF Industries, Nucor, Linde as well. So this is, you know, it's tangible and it's really starting to ramp up and makes a ton of sense. Maybe the last point that I'll mention, I mean, there's multiple examples, but the last one would probably be biofuels. Whether it be Total, Chevron, Exxon, Shell, you know, producing renewable diesel, producing sustainable aviation fuel, the key difference is that you're using lower carbon-intensive feedstocks, right? Used cooking oil, animal fat, et cetera. But the process itself, it's conventional refining process overall, right? And so, again, majors are well-positioned to serve a critical role in the energy transition.
Well, I love ending on ESG. Obviously, it's a core part of what we do at ClearBridge, one of the pioneers in the space for over 35 years. Adam, this has been a tremendous conversation. And I just want to leave the listeners with a couple of tidbits that I found was interesting. So if you look at all the 11 sectors in the S&P 500, energy over the next 12 months, their expected earnings contribution to the index is 6.6%. Their market cap is only 3.7%. So that's a positive difference of 2.9%. So it's a long way of saying that energy is cheap relative to other sectors. In fact, the second cheapest overall. And if you look at the Mag 7, negative 7% compared to their earnings contribution and their market cap. So
interesting.
Obviously a cheap sector. And as we look ahead, I think there's a couple catalysts for potential outperformance. Oil always rises at the end of an economic cycle. So should we have a soft landing? Wouldn't it be a surprise to see higher demand and potentially higher prices? If the Fed eases, soft landing or hard landing, that should boost commodity prices that are linked to the dollar. Sentiment is terrible. A lot of people went underweight energy with the recession fears last year. They're probably going to have to bring some of that exposure back. And then the wild card that we didn't talk about today, China, right? China is starting to get to the point where I think they're going to get a more forceful policy response. And just last week, they cut their five-year LPR, which is the rate that's linked to mortgages, by the largest amount ever. So what we found in the past is that China could change on a dime very quickly. And what's embedded into the pricing right now and the expectations, I think, can change very quickly as we move to the back half of the year. So not sure which one of those catalysts are going to be the spark, but there's certainly a lot of them out there. But Adam, your perspective was invaluable. I know I've personally learned a lot from sitting down with you. So thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you, Jeff.
And thank you, everybody, for joining this podcast. We hope that you'll continue to join us in the new year and welcome any questions, comments, and suggestions, which you can email us at podcast@clearbridge.com. Take care. Please note the following. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. The opinions and views expressed in today's podcast are of the individual speakers as of February 27th, 2024, and may differ from other managers or the firm as a whole, and are not intended to be a forecast of future events, a guarantee of future results, or investment advice. Any statistics referenced have been obtained from sources believed to be reliable, but the accuracy and completeness of this information cannot be guaranteed. Neither ClearBridge Investments nor its information providers are responsible for any damages or losses arising from any use of this information.